Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Big blue skulls, purple shawls, big blue bulls, big blue bulls, let's make little blue evil.
Welcome to Farce Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Pete.
I'm Ben, and welcome back to The Henson Perspective. According to Apple Metrics, the 1,314th most popular TV review podcast on iTunes.
Wow, we're so close to cracking that top 4,000, Ben.
So, we've never said this before, but rate and review.
Yes, please. I want to get above that 1,000.
And otherwise, we do hope you enjoy this episode where we look back at the 45th anniversary of the original New York City broadcast of production episode 15 of the second season of The Muppet Show, guest starring Lou Rawls. Pete,
yes,
we're going to get into Lou Rawls in a moment, but in the introduction of Mr. Rawls, we've had a number of introductions in the past where Kermit provides some context for who this guest is. We'll give him a very brief biography or summary of their accomplishments. In this case, Kermit does not do that thing. Kermit introduces him and just says,
"Hey, tonight's show is going to be a very special one because our guest star is the great Mr. Lou Rawls."
And there's a huge fake applause break as if everybody should know who this person is. I've never heard this man's name outside of reading lists on The Muppet Show.
Interesting.
So I'm excited to find out how blind I've been, potentially, to the cultural omnipresence of Mr. Lou Rawls.
Well, one of my questions will give you some context because you've definitely heard his most famous song at least twice.
Okay.
So, since I've teased that, why don't we jump right into trivia?
I was prevented from, you know, doing any substantial Googling about our guest star in order to remain blind for the trivia, and so I'm interested to be actually told what I should know.
So, question number one. Which soul superstar was Lou Rawls' childhood friends with and got his start singing with in gospel choirs? And in 1958, while on tour with this person, was in a car accident which killed their chauffeur, seriously injured Lou Rawls, who was pronounced dead on the scene, was in a coma for 5 days afterwards. Lou Rawls' memory returned after a few months, and it was over a year before he was fully recovered. Was that R&B soul superstar A, Aretha Franklin, B, James Brown, or C, Sam Cooke?
I'm going to say C.
That is correct. Lou Rawls was in a gospel choir in 1951-ish with Sam Cooke called the Teenage Kings of Harmony.
I was going to say, for 1954, he still seems pretty young in this episode. For him to be performing Teenage Kings would have to be.
Yeah. Question number two. Lou Rawls set himself apart from other soul singers with his monologue style, where, like he does in this episode, seamlessly going from talking into singing. He did this on a song called Dead End Street, which won him his first Grammy. He was nominated for 4 Grammys in his career, and he won 3 of them. The only time he did not win was for his best-selling song of all time, which was released the year before this episode was recorded, and from 1977 to the end of his career, he opened every show with. As an additional helping hand, instead of just having guess a name of a random song, this song has appeared in the following media that you have seen.
Okay.
The Veronica Mars movie.
Okay.
And an episode of That 70s Show. There's lots of those, so that's not actually that. It's also appeared in the Rob Schneider movie The Hot Chick, Shia LaBeouf's Disturbia, the Dax Shepard-directed Kristen Bell movie Hit and Run, which you may or may not have seen, as well as episodes from South Park, Psych, and an episode of My Wife and Kids, where Lou Rawls himself sings it to Damon Wayans while playing the doctor who is giving Damon a colonoscopy. And he uses the colonoscopy scope as his thin microphone. Watch the clip today. It's very funny. So, Ben, is this song that you've never heard of, titled A, A Natural Man, B, Unmistakably Lou, or C, You'll Never Find Another Love Like Mine?
A.
Incorrect. It is You'll Never Find Another Love Like Mine
I didn't think you'd do two C's in a row.
Alphabet. Maybe that's why I do it alphabetically or with some other order, so that way that's out of my hands.
I'll remember that, or try to.
I have told you that before, so.
I know, but I don't remember anything on this podcast. You're the person who remembers everything.
I know. I know that's my responsibility, and I take that burden. Those songs were all his other Grammy nominations. Dead End Street, like I said, was 1968. A Natural Man was 1972. You'll Never Find Another Love Like Mine was 1976. And Unmistakably Lou was 1978. The other reason he may have lost that one is the other three wins were for Best R&B Performance. And You'll Never Find Another Love Like Mine was such a big hit that it was nominated for Best Pop Vocal Performance. And so I think in the bigger picture, he may not have won that because of that. But purely speculation on my part. Question number three. As I have been noticing lately with guest stars, it's very obvious that Lou Rawls was using cue cards throughout this episode. An anecdote in his Wikipedia page sheds light on why Lou Rawls used cue cards in some of his acting roles. What show was he first asked if he wanted to use cue cards, refused, and then messed up his lines? All of these are appearances he did make, but only one of the flubs is real. A. In 1970, on an episode of the first season of Sesame Street, where he was supposed to sing the alphabet song, he got the order of the letters wrong. B. The 14th Annual Grammy Awards in 1972, where he forgot one of the nominees for Best Female R&B Vocalist and had to be prompted. Or C. An episode of Hollywood Squares in 1972, where he forgot what he answered and answered the other way when asked by the host, Peter Marshall, which contradicted what Peter Marshall had on his cards, and Peter had to awkwardly correct Lou.
Boy, if he forgot Adele Dazeem, that would be deeply embarrassing.
No one would ever let him forget that.
I'm gonna say A.
That is correct. He was on the first season of The Sesame Street. That's not what that show's called. Question number four. Lou, in the later years of his career, also did a lot of voiceover work for cartoons. Which show did Lou provide the singing voice for the main character? A. Arnold in Hey Arnold. B. Captain Planet in Captain Planet and the Planeteers. Or C. Garfield in Garfield.
Ooh. C.
That is correct. Lou did the voice of Dr. Rice in one episode of Captain Planet. He did the voice of the beloved character Harvey the Mailman in Hey Arnold. And despite Lorenzo Music having the last name of Music, doing the voice of Garfield, Lou Rawls wrote and performed many songs in some of the specials. Question 5. For which nationally televised presidential inauguration gala did Lou Rawls sing Wind Beneath My Wings? A. Bill Clinton in 1993. B. George H.W. Bush in 1989, or C. Ronald Reagan in 1985?
Clinton.
Incorrect. Good ol' Ronnie, baby.
It makes a certain amount of sense in terms of the timing of his popularity.
Yeah, I didn't listen to his version, but he was apparently very famously known for singing Wind Beneath My Wings, which was news to me. Now, Ben, I have a bonus question for you.
Wow.
I was feeling generous, and I found one other fact that I was like, I have to mention this somehow. So for your bonus question, despite having nothing to do with the movie, on what DVD film commentary does Lou Rawls appear on? A. Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy. B. A Nightmare on Elm Street. C. Wild Things.
B.
Unfortunately, the answer is A. Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy.
Fantastic.
It's listed in his IMDb trivia page, and I was like, amazing.
I love it. And he doesn't appear on the soundtrack?
I also did no more research. So I assume because of the way that was written, he is not on the soundtrack. Maybe he's on the soundtrack. I don't know. So, Ben, you got three questions correct.
As total guessing wild in the dark games go, I'm very pretty good. Happy with that.
Very, very good.
So, tell me a little bit about Lou Rawls in terms of his profile on the national stage, his awareness. So, he was up for all those awards, therefore he was clearly a hit maker. But as you say, some of them were for R&B, and in the 70s and the 80s, R&B was very, as far as I understand, variable in terms of its mainstream crossover. Sometimes only very certain radio stations would play that, and it wouldn't get national airplay otherwise. And so when he was invited to perform for Ronald Reagan, was this something where most people would have been like, oh, that's fantastic. We know who he is, or...
That struck me as... So this was at the height of his popularity. Like mm-hmm. I said, 1976, that song that I asked the question about, You'll Never Find Another Love Like Mine.
That was a huge crossover hit.
His absolute chart-topping hit. Mm-hmm. It's his only number one on the Billboard chart. Okay. I believe it sold over a million singles in 1976 alone. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he's on this show because... He was flying high.
The year before this was filmed.
Yeah, and he had been on Sesame Street, so they clearly were like, hey, you want to do it again? But that was his peak, so I would say that come 85, he's not on the decline, but he didn't maintain the same success.
Mm. Okay.
Something I also didn't find a question for, but would mention is he did a lot of charity work as well. He did a telethon for the United Negro College Fund, raising over $375 million through telethons.
Wow.
Over the course of like 20 years.
Still.
So yeah, very charitable man. There was also a trivia question of like he and his wife, or not trivia question, a factoid. There was a factoid about him that he and his wife were driving through rural Ohio. And on the radio, the local station was talking about a mother who was having problems making her mortgage payments. And Lou apparently called the radio station, was like, how much do I need to give you guys to get to her to make her current on her mortgage payments so she doesn't lose her house? So very, very generous man. But yeah, transitioned from being just a soul singer to this voiceover and acting career, mostly as himself. He did do some...
Dramatic.
Yeah, he was in an episode of Mannix.
But we've talked before, at this era, you tend to find people who are playing thinly veiled versions of themselves. They have a different name, but they basically are playing their same career mm-hmm. on The Love Boat or on Hawaii Five-0, and they just show up and they're like, hi, you know me, I'm Shmoo Schmalls.
Yep. And I think in the 70s, that's what he was doing. I think this was early enough in his acting career that he wasn't comfortable with it.
Yeah, he's not quite there as a performer. He doesn't move his lips when somebody else is talking. He doesn't react to a line before it happens. He doesn't have any of those classic woodenly bad actors, but he's also not engaging with the Muppets or his surroundings in any sort of recognizably genuine way.
Nor are they giving him many opportunities to do so.
But he does have two sketches on the show that begin dialogue heavy mm-hmm. before they one of them turns into a song. And so he is given an opportunity to interact with the Muppets in that classic... One, in that classic talk show way, and the other in a sketch that I'm going to harp on considerably, thinks it's in the real world.
Yeah.
So I think they are assuming that he has a certain kind of verisimilitude that he can bring to the screen, but they don't want him to be doing characters, per mm-hmm. se.
Yes.
Which, aside from people like Ruth Buzzi or...
They don't often ask that exactly. of non-sketch or actor performers.
Yeah.
But as I'm going to harp on throughout this episode, you've said before that one of the things that Jim Henson prided himself on was when we have a guest star on The Muppet Show, we want them to do something that could only be done on The Muppet Show.
Yes.
And that is not the case for any of Lou Rawls's performances. No.
They're very little stretching.
No. Here. So why don't we jump into it so that way we can talk about these things more in detail as we get to them.
As opposed to abstractly.
Yeah.
Well, Pete, we've been noting the fact that the episodes have been opening with 15 seconds to curtain almost mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a wild variation, or a wide variation on that in this episode, where Scooter comes in and says... 24 seconds to curtain, which is necessary because we then have a dialogue scene after that.
Yeah. And we get another very, very close to thank you 24 because Lou says, thank you, Scooter. Also, since we've started noting it, the picture on the door is of Piggy and Kermit looking at each other.
Which we've seen in a previous episode. Okay. I didn't check to see which episode it appeared in, but I will say that this episode happens, the production episode, after Elton John. Okay. So my first check would be that one.
Well, while we're talking about the time as well,
yeah,
the cut to curtain was at 22 seconds, so not
They gave him a little bit more time yeah. than they needed.
This then cuts to, after he thanks Scooter, Sam is in the dressing room, addressing him as he gets ready and talking about how much of a big fan he is and that he's sad that, unfortunately, his career, which he's followed for this long, now has to come to an end here on the show.
And then Lou does a double take direct to camera.
Yeah.
As we cut to the curtain. It was fun.
Yeah, the...
I like the double take, I should say.
I didn't like the double take. It was the first indication that he may not be fluid as an actor to me. It wasn't, obviously it's comedic, but it was not knowing him as a performer. It felt wildly over the top. It felt Don Knotts level of over the top. And so I was like, oh no, what kind of a persona do we have here? And I don't think that's his actual persona that he has later in the show.
No.
And so on rewatching it, I was like, oh, he's going big, but that's maybe not the right way to go.
Yeah, I thought it was fun, but I can see yours. We go to the opening, and then Statler and Waldorf, Statler cries out, "We're old men."
And Waldorf chimes in by saying, "Give us a break."
Would have been better if it was to the rhythm. But I liked it.
And then when Gonzo comes out in the O, he blows green smoke out through the trumpet, which then also makes a foghorn noise as the smoke comes out. And he, in amazement, stares up at the billows of smoke and says, "Green smoke." Is this a repeat?
We saw it in the Steve Martin episode.
Okay.
Yes.
When we go to the opening curtain, we have the introduction of what will be the runner for the episode. Because after...
Oh, the skater. Might be the skater, Ben. I didn't know Tony Hawk was the guest star of this episode.
If I had known that you were going to be this hawkish about this pun, I might have waved a white flag.
No, Ben, we saw Tony... We saw Sam the Eagle in the cold open. We didn't see any hawks. Although, that reminds me, that Dead End Street song that I mentioned earlier that he won his first Grammy for, one of the monologue, like talking monologues that he goes on, he mentions hawks in it.
Where, curiously, and we'll get to this later, amongst the many birds that he lists, raptors, aside from an owl, do not feature.
Yeah, maybe Lou Rawls likes birds. I wish I made this connection beforehand. I probably would have done some more research on, does Lou Rawls like birds?
Quick, Google, does Lou Rawls like birds?
Does Lou Rawls like... Nope, it's not autofilling. From the lyrics from the song, "Room with a View," "We'll be as happy and contented as birds upon a tree, high above the mountains and the sea. We'll bill and we'll coo-oo-oo."
However, as we'll get to later, I don't believe Lou Rawls wrote a lot of his own music. So unless he was going to his songwriters and saying, "I need more bird imagery."
From the song "Spring Again," the chorus, "It's spring again, I can hear the birds sing again." From the song "Down Here on the Ground," "Watching the sparrows fly high, I watch the birds as they make their wings."
You know, I think you found the basis of a minor academic essay.
From the song "Sleigh Ride," "Outside the snow is falling and friends are calling, yoo-hoo, we're snuggled up together like two birds of a feather would be."
Okay, we have to draw a line under this. We can't just read off bird lyrics from Lou Rawls' repertoire for the rest of the episode.
"Oh, whispering grass, don't you tell it to the breeze, because she will tell the birds and bees." All right, I'm done.
Anyway.
The skater.
In front of the curtain, the extended plot reoccurrence that repeatedly features throughout the episode is that Fozzie is doing his act on roller skates, and while he is supposed to open the show, he skates past Kermit out of control and crashes with a different sound of pots and pans as he goes off screen.
"I think the act needs just a bit more rehearsal!"
It's less clattery.
Mm-hmm. And then Kermit says, "Well, I guess we're not going to be able to do that, so let's go into the opening number."
We've unexpectedly arrived at guest star time.
So I think it's interesting that we've been talking about opening with the guest has been surprising us, and Kermit also considers it unexpected. But due to perilous wheel circumstances, we have, ladies and gentlemen, Lou Rawls, and he sings "Groovy People." Based on the songwriters who also wrote "You're the One,"
oh, okay.
I'm guessing that this is a Lou Rawls song from his album.
I could find no record of it in his list of singles. None of these three songs were on it. So that's one of the reasons why I told you
you could search them for the impunity.
Yeah, because I have a feeling, I mean, these may have been songs that he knew and sang, but they were not songs by or recorded by him, or at least weren't singles, which again, I was shocked to find out considering his biggest song of all time came out the year before this. It seems wild to me that he didn't perform it.
So, both You're the One and Groovy People are written by Kenneth Gamble and Leon Huff. And Groovy People appears, according to the Muppet Wikia, on the album All Things in Time, mm-hmm. which is one of Lou Rawls' albums.
Ben?
Yeah?
I'm a bad researcher.
The other song, You're the One, doesn't seem to appear on a Lou Rawls album. Leon Huff later recorded in 1989 an album where he's collecting some of his own songwriting, and it seems to appear on that. But based on a very surface skim, I assumed that these were Motown-esque mm-hmm. factory songwriters that were producing songs for, you know, jobbing artists, and that he used them a bunch of times. But I didn't follow up to see how many other songs on the album were by Gamble and Huff.
Understood.
So that is a half-formed possible fact. A factoid, if you will, which is the correct definition of that word. Something that sounds like a fact, but probably isn't.
Sounds like most of my thoughts.
Anyway, Groovy People features Lou coming out in a pink three-piece suit with a cream white-collared button-down shirt with an enormous collar that's buttoned up tight, barely revealing a golden cord that he has knotted around his neck. The width of his collars and this gold cord will feature prominently in every outfit that he wears on the show. Otherwise, he has some pretty great color combinations and outfits over the course of the episode, and he shows off some dynamite style. Mm-hmm. Some very 77 choices. In the second verse, in the beginning of the chorus, he's joined by four Muppets with crazy whatnot colored skin and loose, fluffy, feathery hair and very big, wide mouths, who are all wearing disco variations on the maroon velvet suit that the band wears. It's mm-hmm. the same basic velour color, except it has big sequined lapels on them. They join in with shooby-doo whoops and ahs and singing along to the chorus with him. These guys are wild.
Do you know what their name is, Ben? The Wikia names them.
Okay. No. What's the name?
The Sleaze Brothers.
Now, what's the source of that?
Let me click on it mm-hmm. and find out. Well, apparently, two of them are named Sam Sleaze and Sid Sleaze. Those are clickable and also... Nope. Sid Sleaze is the name of Joe Flaherty.
In Follow That Bird.
Yep. And so now I'm clicking on Sam Sleaze.
That's another...
That's Dave Thomas yep. in Follow That Bird.
I was going to say, that's another Second City performer who shows up in Follow That Bird. That's a weird coincidence, or weird, we're using our own material yep. again.
Yeah, no one knows that these are called the Sleaze Brothers, so we're gonna use this again.
They're very fun, and they do a very unusual move in this, which is that as they're dancing and sort of doing their back and forth tooby-doo wops, as they come back on for the final chorus, they spin around in place, mm-hmm. which is a very realistic recreation of a dance move that you would do on stage.
Yes.
It's showy. It's very Soul Train. It's mm-hmm. exactly that kind of thing that you would do. But it's a move for a puppeteer that's fairly complicated. Doing a spot turn spin, are you doing it with just your arm? Are you underneath the stage turning around your whole body? I'm not sure. I assume the latter. Mm-hmm. But it's never been done before. And this episode features...
About 100 of them.
Correct. But it starts off here. And I think it's interesting that as we get back to the skating plot line, there will be spins and there will be turns and there will be pirouettes on skates. That I think they were like, we figured out this new thing. Mm-hmm. Let's have these guys do it. Because we might as well replicate the Soul backup dancer experience with this new move that we figured out.
But, and Lou sounds great.
Uh-huh.
But as you said, this could have just been Soul Train.
Mm.
There's nothing about this that, like, yes, it's the first time the Muppets are doing it, but Soul Train has been doing that move for decades at this point. So that's my point of this could
have
been...
The Muppets aren't adding anything particular to this.
Nope.
I think the Sleaze Brothers are very fun. I think that Lou doesn't really acknowledge their presence. He's basically singing to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
There's a close-up on him when they go off stage, and he is sweating up a storm. He is clearly really performing this. Mm-hmm. Not just because, as you talked about, his ability to move into sort of Sprexinga, to add new lyrics and to talk and to have a little bit of patter with the people to whom he's singing.
I don't like nosy people. You know what I'm talking about, nosy folks. Get in my business and things.
Does that multiple times, and I think because of that, they weren't able to do any backing tracks because that's not his flow.
Yeah.
So he's doing this live under the lights, and he's feeling it, but he's also concentrating so hard that he's not really giving anything except, as you say, I'm doing this on Soul Train, I'm doing this on Top of the Pops.
Mm-hmm.
And there just happen to be people standing 6 feet below me.
Well, Statler agrees with me
that
Lou Rawls is one fantastic singer.
Waldorf points out that he is also a fantastic singer and asks Statler if he'd like to hear him sing.
Statler says only if you sing solo.
Waldorf is confused by this and repeats, solo?
And Statler finishes the joke by saying, solo, I can't hear you.
So, I've never seen this episode before. As I was pausing this to write down the dialogue, I finished that joke in advance and then hit unpause and was very victorious about the fact that that was the joke that it was going to be. I mean, that also means it's kind of an obvious joke, but also well delivered, well played.
And Waldorf makes crunchy face, yes, which really I does. Always appreciate.
As we go backstage, Scooter comes on to say, hey, Chief, I thought that you said that we were going to do Fozzie as the opening spot on the show. And this gets into the extended, long-patterned backstage secondary plot theme of the episode. As I tie myself in knots, as to not say running.
Where... Why would you do that? I'd never overcorrect you.
And of Kermit saying that everything's going not according to plan because Fozzie hasn't yet figured out how to skate.
Yeah, Scooter wants to know if Newsman or Fozzie's going on next. We then see Fozzie yell off from off screen and skate towards the stage and crashing. And then Scooter and Kermit look at each other and Scooter, without needing to be told, just says, I'll go tell the Newsman he's on.
And then there's the classic sideways Newsman wipe. And as Kermit has gone to stage, the...
Maybe he's making sure Fozzie's not on stage.
Or he's pulling the rope for the curtain. Yeah. Either way, the set for the Newsman is all ready to rock. And the Newsman runs on stage with his story. Dateline New York. Medical science has been baffled by a sudden epidemic of the rare disease Mallarditis.
The Newsman then editorializes that Mallarditis is the silliest thing that he's ever heard of.
And as he's just about to say a key word in the sentence and pop, he suddenly has a duck head.
And starts quacking and then walking off stage.
Embarrassed and...
dejectedly just quacking.
I get confused sometimes with the Latinate endings. But I'm pretty sure itis means inflammation of. So Mallarditis would mean you have an inflamed duck. Not that you are transforming into a duck, but that you have a duck that is irritated and increasing in blood flow, size, and bruising.
Yeah, pathology, suffix denoting diseases characterized by inflammation.
Should have been Mallardosis.
Yeah, I suppose. But maybe it was in the common vernacular.
Oh, slapping itis on the end of something to denote that it's a disease is very much the common vernacular. I'm just being picky.
Wait, what? I would never correct you if you said something like runner.
Then we have the fade out from the Muppet Newsflash, and we go directly to Vets Hospital, which isn't that unusual in terms of...
Finish it?
Yep. Yeah. Which isn't that unusual in terms of the Muppet Newsflash is often used as a wipe, but it still felt a little bit like going from a sketch to a sketch, and that struck me as a little bizarre.
Well, then, it's also not unusual to be loved by anyone.
What was that about you never pick me up on a verbal tick? Hmm. Hmm, Pete. Hmm.
Ben, I think it's been obvious from me also saying I would never correct you on runners that I also have them.
I'm just saying, of all the things that you could forget, why can't this be one of them?
So with Vets Hospital, it begins with Piggy and Janice are already looking for the voice during the intro. Animal Watch, there's no patient. There are jokes about losing patients with a homonym of patience for patience. And then it's a very short one, because then the announcer comes on after what feels like a very short time.
Yeah, they basically have done two jokes.
Yeah, and then Rolf interrupts the announcer and asks who he is, finally, after all this time. The announcer says, I'm the announcer, I'm the guy who says, and now Veterinarian's Hospital, the continuing story.
And the music starts back up again underneath that, and they reset and go back to Mark 1.
Yep, it starts to sketch over, while Piggy and Janice are already looking for the voice during the intro. Ben, Animal Watch, there's no animal. There's jokes about losing patients and patients, and then as the announcer comes on after what feels like a very short Vets Hospital,
he says... Yeah, it's only like two jokes.
Yeah, it's very odd. The announcer says, and so Dr. Bob has done all the same jokes twice. Tune in next time to see Nurse Jenna say, shall we go for thirds? Dr. Bob doesn't want to do it again because that would try his patience, which triggers Piggy to start midway through the sketch, and they do it another half time. Lots of fun.
It is a lot of fun. It's really enjoyable that they either figured out that they only had half of a Vets Hospital sketch and therefore they needed to do it again in order to fill out the time, or that they just liked the idea of talking to the announcer would trigger him explaining it and then that would start it over again.
Yeah, it very much reminded me of the improv game Halftime.
Yes.
Where you do a scene and then you do it in half the time and then you do it a third time in half the second time, whittling it down until you have to do the whole scene in 1 second.
Yeah, because they do perform the second time round at basically 1.5 podcast speed.
Yeah.
Where they're saying the lines, but they're saying it more quickly, and it's most noticeable when they laugh at their own jokes that they go, ha 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 ha, sped up in that way.
Yeah.
Well, I never lose my patience.
What about the one you fed nitroglycerin to?
Him I lost.
When it started, I was disappointed with the lack of Piggy business, but then because of the Groundhog Day nature of it, I understood why they had to be looking for the voice already.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to point out, is that it gives the impression that this isn't the first time this has happened.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're looking up at the beginning, we might have just tuned in at a never-ending loop of the show.
Yeah, this could still be happening. We then cut to Lou being in an alleyway behind the theater, which we've never seen before.
Okay, it's implied that it's in an alleyway behind the theater, except that what's only definite is that it looks like the outside of a building.
Mm-hmm.
And Lou runs into Floyd taking Animal for a walk.
Yes.
However, this is clean, well-lit, really open, and there eventually turns out to be traffic speeding by, none of which says alley. We have commented on the fact that there is an alley behind the theater because that's where the chickens wanted their chicken coop and where Gonzo had to get dressed when he was supposed to be not in the dressing room of somebody else. So entering in the back of the theater into an alley is what it should have been. But somebody wisely probably didn't want a multi-star black man stepping out into a dingy dark alley.
Or, alternate take, this is a set supposed to look like an alley and not actually supposed to be taking place in the alley, but behind
it. Well, it's a street set, and that they're using it as the back of the theater. But, you know, whether it's the Mr. Cellophane set and they just moved it down to the end of the city block, you know, they have had the ability to do city streets before. But when we did Mr. Cellophane, it was a sketch on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
It was somebody performing on the recreation of a city set in the Muppet Theater.
Yeah, this is taking place of the dressing room bit.
Correct. And it is happening outside the theater. However, Floyd talks to camera twice.
Come on, Floyd, just let me discuss it with you man to man, you know?
Man to man? This dude don't know animal.
So this is still happening to the mythical audience of the show, but not the audience of the show.
But the dressing room segments have takes directly to camera sometimes.
Yep. And so the idea that there's something going on backstage that the audience can see has been well established. Mm-hmm. The idea that there's a show within the show, but it's always happened inside the building.
Mm-hmm.
We have now broken out from that, but there's still a wildly unfeasible office-esque camera crew following around, now going outside for this highly staged encounter.
With an audience laugh track.
That's right. But it still can't be on the stage. This isn't a sketch that's happening on the stage that they could then cut to the Muppet audience watching this.
Why couldn't it, though? That's what I was saying.
Because the car passing, and because the nature of
it's
the conversation.
Just good acting.
But this is a completely new exploding of the space in which the Muppet Show can take place. And I can't help but think that there's some unconscious racism going on here, in that they needed to have Lou Rawls in a city setting, in an urban setting, in order for him to have this casual conversation. Or they just couldn't come up with a better premise than taking Animal for a walk, and so they
wanted to have him run around with cars, yeah, after cars.
Yeah. They were just like, yeah, it destroys all the reality of the show, but we don't care. We're going to have it be that way.
Well, because as we've long talked about, there is no reality to the show.
There's no consistent reality to the show.
Right. So they don't care.
But
it's only us 45 years later that wants there to be a reality to everything.
I don't think that's true. Because think about this from a production standpoint. If they didn't have the set from Mr. Cellophane lying around someplace, then they said, okay, in order to do this very innocuous Animal Lou Rawls interaction,
maybe there's going to be outside theater segments from now on.
This is what's come up with our conversations in the past when they needed to create a major set, whether it's the Sam's lectern space, mm-hmm, or whether it's a major prop like Vendaface, where they're like, okay, we need to pay out the cost of this over several sketches. I will be very surprised if this comes back. But I was very surprised that the wall, the talk spot, came, mm-hmm, back. I was very surprised that
Vendaface came back.
I was very surprised that At the Dance came back.
Mm-hmm.
I was very surprised that a couple things that I've said, oh, well, that's been done, we're never going to see that again, have returned. Mm-hmm. So these things do exist out there in the world sometimes. I am not the Nostradamus of Muppet Show. I don't know as much as I think I do.
But yeah, this was wild. You can tell Lou's using cue cards.
Mm.
He does a good job at looking up at them and then delivering the line. Unlike Bob Hope.
When they're talking, he's looking down and past them.
Yep, and talking to them. He's not reading off the card and then looking down at them. He's right, checking to make sure he knows what he's about to say and then saying it to them.
Right.
Still frustrating, but not as frustrating as Bob Hope.
Yeah. I walked over your mention of Bob Hope before. What did Bob Hope do? Was he just also doing a lot of cue cards in his episode?
I didn't notice as much in the talking moments, but in the horse song.
Okay.
It was all cue cards.
Yeah, I don't think we talked about that in that episode.
I mentioned it. You may cut it out.
Okay. I haven't edited that yet.
Okay. So. I definitely mentioned it there.
Good enough. Then hopefully we'll cut all this out. The upshot of this is, as you say, it's an excuse to have Animal pull Lou Rawls back and forth across the set as he clings onto his leash, which is made of linked chains.
And an excuse to do a miscommunication translation joke, because Floyd speaks both Jive and Animal. Mm-hmm. So Lou can talk to Floyd in his cool hip cat speech.
Oh, yeah. You have to know how to talk to him.
Oh, yeah? Well, how do you tell a man that his work with the sticks really is down? I mean, he can put some soul in the bowl, you know what I mean?
Yeah, okay, that's easy.
And then Animal can speak to Floyd in Animal.
We have mentioned the last couple episodes that there were a lot of guests who, when they were asked to be on the show and they said, what do you want to do, said, I want to do something with Miss Piggy. This felt like Lou wanted to do something with Animal.
Which I think that holds a lot of water based off of his reaction to Animal in a later segment,
yes,
as well.
Yes, I agree. Where he has a lot of joy for a very silly joke.
Yeah. And you mentioned the camera take, mm-hmm, but there were a lot of interesting like insert shots and close-ups in this that I was like, the Muppet Show doesn't do this. And this was a Philip Casson episode.
based on what you're talking about in terms of Rawls's comfort with his performance, my guess is those insert shots were done so that he didn't have to be on camera.
But one of them was a close-up on him.
Yep, that's true. But there were definitely some close-ups on Animal and close-ups on Floyd that would have given him the opportunity to not have to be reacting on camera, or give them the opportunity to edit around if he was good for a couple of minutes and then lost it.
Yep, very true. We then go backstage. Scooter's talking to the Swedish chef, who also isn't ready to go on, but Fozzie still needs more time, so Kermit and Scooter push the Swedish chef on stage.
Okay, the Swedish chef, we established in a recent episode, obviously is played by Jim Henson, and we have Kermit and Swedish chef on screen together. And last time this came up, we talked about the fact that maybe Frank Oz, because he's the body and hands of the Swedish chef, could have been done doing this. But here we have Fozzie as Fozzie, and we have Jim Henson as Kermit. So who is playing Swedish Chef?
According to the fandom page, it's Jim Henson.
Yeah.
I have a feeling maybe someone else is puppeteering Kermit, and it's either pre-recorded or Jim is jumping back and forth.
Well, the Swedish Chef starts talking and then is quiet for the rest of this particular backstage sketch. So I think Jim is Kermit in this, and either he did a voice switch for that one line or it was pre-recorded. Later, this will be different.
Yes, absolutely. So after Scooter and Kermit force Chef on stage, who, I don't know how they did this, because it was clearly a, we need you to go on stage now. But then when the camera cuts, the Swedish Chef's music is already playing.
That's right.
And then he's pushed on. So the house knew that he was going on, even though he didn't, I guess? Question mark?
Again, much like the set of the Muppet Newsflash already be waiting and ready when supposedly Fozzie was about to go on.
Yep.
We gotta give mad props to those backstage Muppet monsters who know how to dress John Cleese in a flash and know how to get a set in position in half a second.
Yeah, despite Kermit being the worst house manager of all time, that crew is the best crew of all time.
One of the reasons why he can afford to be so bad is because there are a bunch of 8-foot monsters who can get things ready even when he's screwing up.
It's revealed that the dish that the Swedish chef is preparing, but wasn't ready to, is Frugsleegs.
Because after he pulls out the sleazy, slicey, neefy, knifey, and gestures at the cover to what the dish is, Nephew Robin is underneath the dish and squalling at the idea that his legs are about to be cut off.
He shouts for help. Kermit and Scooter rush back on stage, and Scooter pushes the Swedish chef back off stage.
Kermit yells, cut to the camera, and Robin protests, don't say cut, say stop.
Very good, very chaotic.
Yeah, this to me was the best version of what they've been building to this whole time. Fozzie not being ready is causing the Muppet Show to almost fall apart. And I loved this. I loved them pushing him on halfway through the theme and him just picking it up and running with it. I loved his irritation at what was going on. And the surprise reveal of Robin was, again, doesn't quite work that he's just been quietly sitting under this.
Yeah, he should have been screaming long before.
But
that
as
terrine should have been shaking.
That's right. I mean, maybe he's just gotten so used to being under a big hat. True. That just
it just feels natural at this
for
point.
Him to be surrounded by darkness and closed spaces. But this is exactly what I want the Muppet Show to be, is figuring it out live.
Mm-hmm. And once this finishes, we go, as you alluded to earlier, back to At the Dance.
And we have a classic At the Dance.
Yep.
Where we have
2 weeks ago,
jokes.
When we had the fake out song, we've got the 5 jokes.
After they do their 4 jokes, the 5th joke is that the dancer's horoscope said that she would have a...
She needed to be careful today.
Because a great physical harm could befall her.
Mm-hmm. And then as her and her partner continue dancing underneath the chandelier, it falls and hits only her.
Mm.
It does not hit him for our first and only hit of the episode.
Any of the other jokes worth mentioning?
I like the Jaws one.
Mm. Did you like the Jaws one just because it was Frank doing the voice.
So, what'd you think of the movie Jaws?
I had a note saying a whatnot who sounds like a drunk Fozzie. No, otherwise it was fine.
I liked how chaotic it was. Liked that it was it's kind of a different collection of jokes. It wasn't the same dad joke stuff.
No, it wasn't on a theme. It was just 5 separate jokes. But as you alluded to, no, I hated this because Pogo George wasn't in it.
I will merely point out that Gonzo has a bit where he accosts a monster saying,
"Excuse me, are you the monster who swallowed my harmonica?"
The monster then opens his mouth and produces the sound of harmonica, and Gonzo then chases him off camera trying to get his harmonica back. One of the most sweaty setups we've ever encountered. But I did like that after that, we see Gonzo in the background dancing by himself with his arms out in the waltz position, but he doesn't have a partner.
Yep. That may have been one of my potential moments, but it's fine. I have others because, my note said, Gonzo dancing by himself in the background. It's no Pogo George, but it's almost as good.
I just think it's fun that he's quite cheerfully doing it. It's not... Yeah. Because a previous fake at the dance was Gonzo doing the Why Won't Somebody Dance With Me song. And now he's chill.
Yeah, he's happy to be dancing by himself.
He's out there on the dance floor. He's having a good time. And there's a chicken dancing with T.R. Rooster. And he's not mooning after the chicken. He's just having a great time going stag.
Yep, Gonzo don't need no chicken.
After at the dance, we go to the musical number Ukulele Lady, which features Piggy sitting in a crescent moon in a lei and a skirt. I spent an inordinate amount of time in this trying to figure out if that was a miniature Piggy puppet or whether or not they'd just constructed an enormous depth of field and had a set that was much deeper than we're used to, so she could be far enough away that she could, in fact, appear in miniature behind them.
Yeah, and also the way that worked, I spent a fair amount of time trying to figure out that. Mm-hmm. Because, it's a cutout raised above, but the cutout moves.
The whole screen that she's sitting in shifts back and forth. Yeah. There's a lot of side-to-side. If there's a theme to this episode, it's side-to-side movement.
Yeah.
It's Fozzie crashing past the stage on roller skates.
In fact, some things are moving around quite a lot.
And then Lou Rawls being pulled back and forth. We'll get to more of them, but we now have the whole flat that Piggy is sitting in swaying from side to side over the course of this song.
That I didn't think of the whole flat. I thought it was just the circle moving. But no. It's absolutely the whole flat. Thank you, Ben.
Ukulele Lady is a fairly old song. And I believe it's from 1927 or 28. And it actually has a pretty lengthy history of being covered. The website Secondhand Songs lists 44 different covers of it over the history of time. Here's a little quiz for you. Which Muppet Show guest didn't cover this song? Peter Sellers, Ethel Merman, or Jim Nabors?
Peter Sellers.
Nope, he did it. Mm. Peter Sellers performed it with the Temperance Seven sometime in the 1950s. And Ethel Merman did it, I believe, in 1960 even. I thought that the interesting cover that may have been done recently enough to reinvigorate this in the Muppet Show performers' minds was Arlo Guthrie performed it on his 1972 album. But curiously, a group called Jim Queskin and the Jug Band performed this. Why isn't this a Jug Band song?
I mean, it works better on a ukulele.
When first listening to this, before I researched it and found that Wikipedia calls it an evergreen standard, I just assumed this was a comic novelty song of cultural appropriation, where somebody was like, I sure do like that luau sound. Let me do a goofy song to that, because that's basically how it plays in terms of the lyrics. It's a song about if you woo a lady with your ukulele,
make sure that you don't just go and woo another lady with your ukulele, because otherwise the first one's going to be mad, but then the third verse is, nah, she'll be fine without you.
Yeah.
It's a very strange narrative, but it's very entertainingly performed.
Yeah, it's Kermit playing on the uke, and then Scooter and a Scooter-looking other whatnot.
A very proto-80s whatnot.
Yeah. With
spiky, slightly punk hair, and very slick sunglasses, and a Hawaiian shirt.
And the choreography is fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good segment. We then fade to black and come back up on the UK spot. Which, for the third week in a row, Ben, we have an episode with a live animal.
Now, Sunny Boy is an incredibly
boring song.
You won't do this, but one of my favorite episodes of Fry and Laurie's adaptations of the Jeeves and Wooster stories involves a prank where, in order to make a friend of Worcester's look terrible in the eyes of his fiance, they have him sing Sunny Boy at a music hall performance, but they do it after three other people have just performed the song.
Ugh.
So that when he gets up there full of piss and vinegar and being like, I am this amazing singer, I'm going to impress this girl by singing this song to you lowly masses, they've heard it so many times that within the first couple bars, they all throw tomatoes and rotten cabbage at him because they're just like, we're so sick of this stupid song. And it's hilarious, in my opinion.
Well, then, I got to that point after the third word of this song.
But what I wanted to bring up, since you mentioned the live animal, is we have Link Hogthrob holding what he claims to be his son,
mm-hmm.
a live pig, cradling in his arms and singing to it in this very traditional British hymn to fatherhood. Did you think this was more or less abusive than Rolf holding the dog in the first episode of the second season with Don Knotts?
I felt like this was less abusive because I don't think the animal was drugged.
And that was my question. You came on very strongly with your feelings that there was no way that dog was that placid without massive amounts of...
I am nodding vigorously.
And that Jim Henson, as Rolf, was holding that animal.
Mm-hmm.
Who plays Link Hogthrob?
Jim Henson.
That's right. And so I thought it was interesting that once again we have Jim Henson cradling an animal and praying that animal will be docile for the length of a song that's in the UK spot. This pig seems pretty chill.
Yep.
This pig makes me think, oh, that's what people think when they buy a Vietnamese pot-bellied pig and don't expect it to turn into the size of their kitchen.
Yep.
They're like, oh, it's cute and it's little and it's quiet and it'll be fine and it'll stay this way forever.
And then 350 pounds later.
If you're lucky.
Yeah. Yeah, no, if it wasn't for the live pig, I would have thought this was terrible.
What'd you think about the joke in the middle of this?
Ben, I forgot there was a joke in the middle of it because I was so bored by it. And even now, I know there were jokes in it. I could not tell you anything about them.
Pete, you watched this episode in preparation for this week right after the Super Bowl. And this is a pig/pigskin joke.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And it is weird.
Yeah.
Because the premise of this song is a heartfelt father sings to his son. And the joke in between the end of the second verse and the beginning of the repeat of the chorus is,
when you grow up, you know you might be a halfback. Or you might even be a fullback. Or, if you really persevere, you might grow up and be a football.
It's a good joke.
It's so out of keeping with everything else that the sketch is doing. I find it incredibly bizarre.
See, if I wasn't bored to sleep by the first minute and a half, I may have been able to pay attention to the joke.
Moving on, or roller skating past violently,
We then go to, as I mentioned before, the return of the talk spot. We have the wall.
We do.
We mentioned in the Peter Sellers episode that Sellers had said, I don't want to be standing at the interview wall as myself. I want to be in character. And I scoffed, saying, they don't even use the interview wall in season two. Again, I'm wrong about a lot of things.
Well, because they had used a different interview wall once or twice.
But mostly they'd switched to the dressing room.
Yeah.
And so to have it come back, that they dug it out of storage for this bit, really surprised me.
But it did serve a purpose.
It very much served a purpose. Because the premise here is that Kermit is interviewing Lou. They're talking about how do you sing jazz. It's all very in keeping with the kind of questions that you would ask that had been asked in the past on the talk spot wall. But then it transitions into the band magically appearing behind him, much as the teleportation in the Peter Sellers episode had perfected.
Oh, they blooped into existence for sure.
The band bloops in order to then sing and play along with him to the song Bye Bye Blackbird. And Kermit bloops out of there pretty fast, not in an actual teleportation, but makes a lot of unnecessary small talk of like, I'm not going to intrude on your... Kermit's whole thing is, I don't really get your jazz talk.
I want to learn, and but then also, he tries to repeat it, and it comes off as a square.
Lay down some golden tones with soul and style.
Sure, you just kind of... lay back and lay down some golden tones with soul and style.
Yeah, and so he's really kind of comes across as scared of saying the wrong thing because he's trying to be hip to the jive. But we've talked before about how Kermit's very awkward about this stuff and dad jokes his way into saying these things in such a way that it's clear he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And now faced with a real live human being that could be offended by this, he's scared out of his mind.
But there's also another reason for this, which is Jim Henson is also Dr. Teeth.
That's right.
Has to scat in about 45 seconds.
Yes, so the first line of Bye Bye Blackbird is performed by Floyd, and then Lou jumps in, and this is where we get the bird riffs. At the end of the second line, instead of saying Bye Bye Blackbird, he says Bye Bye You Jive Turkey You. And then after a couple of more lines, he then starts singing, which bird is it supposed to be? And goes on a whole list of birds, which I have here if you don't have it.
I do not have it.
We have chicken, turkey, owl, parrot, parakeet, pheasant, partridge, minor bird, kiwi bird, hummingbird, red bird. And then it ends with big bird, with a nice take to camera.
Mm-hmm.
This is then what precedes that each of the performers doing a line of scat, and then
Lou answers or responds.
Yep. And it goes from Floyd to Janice to Zoot to Dr. Teeth and then Animal. And it's interesting that Jim felt he needed to go into Dr. Teeth mode for this because he's really not great at it.
No.
Jim is a very good singer and has done wonderful performances as a wide variety of characters over the course of the show. And I was surprised how much he really couldn't pull off scatting as Dr. Teeth.
It may have also been a byproduct of not wanting to overstep or step on, because Floyd and Janice are competent but don't do any bits.
Mm-hmm.
Zoot has a bit, Animal has a bit. And so he may have just gone back down so that way
they could quickly move past him to the funny bit.
Yeah. And not then having to step on Zoot's funny bit.
Mm-hmm. Zoot's funny bit is that after doing a line of syllables, he then does a second line into the bell of the saxophone where it echoes hilariously. And you mentioned that Lou finds Animal's bit really funny.
Yeah, because Animal's version of scatting is by saying the word scat twice. He goes, scat, scat, boom, boom, hut-hoo, hut-hoo. with about as much rhythm as I just and vocalization as I just gave it.
Bye Bye Blackbird is a absolutely classic jazz standard from 1926 and has been performed by pretty much every amazing person who does jazz standards. A lot of white people, but also some of the really great jazz musicians that you would want to have performed a song of that vintage. But I will just say, there are some weird people on this list. Carol Channing performed a version of this in 1965. Of course, Wayne Newton and Rosemary Clooney performed it. And of course, Anthony Newley performed it. But then between 2000 and 2020, there are something like 50 recordings of this song. Wow. It continues to be a very well-respected, very popular song that people return to again and again. The Secondhand Songs website is invaluable for collecting recorded covers that are either done in concert recordings or are released on albums. And the names here run from the popular to the obscure, but it's very clear that this is a song that people come back and back and back to.
Well, Lou Rawls isn't the only person who loves scatting, because Statler says he just loves scat.
And Waldorf says, what?
Statler repeats himself saying scat, scat.
And
this one, I'm going to guess you didn't guess what the punchline was.
No. This one,
I thought this was going in a different direction.
No, because while the German internet loves certain things, that's not really where the Muppet Show goes. And so he says, what is there, a pussycat around here?
And then Statler gives surprised face. Waldorf gave scrunchy face. Statler gives surprised face.
After that, we have the continuation of the backstage bits. And
Kermit, having slunk away previously, is backstage congratulating the Electric Mayhem on a good job.
Where we only had two of the Sleazy Brothers walk past, we do have three of the members of the band walking past.
Sleaze Brothers, Ben. They're not sleazy.
Two of the Sleazoid Brothers walking past, but all, we have three of the Electric Mayhem, including Floyd doing his classic walk.
Mm-hmm.
Fozzie, Kermit says, is if he's going to do his skating act, he's got to do it soon. And Fozzie then wheels himself onto stage, basically claiming that he's most of the way there.
Yeah, he's not
fully balanced, but
he's competently doing it.
He's got that marvelous, for, you know, a non-human person, Fozzie does an admirable job of conveying both being proud that he's sort of able to accomplishment, but also teetering on the edge of nervousness. And considering he doesn't really have facial expressions, this is some excellent puppeteering going on here.
As Fozzie reassures Kermit that he's fine,
he's been working very hard at accomplishing this, but Kermit, you have to understand how difficult it is to be good on skates.
At that exact moment, Swedish Chef enters singing while effortlessly skating around backstage.
Doing a very good spin.
Mm-hmm.
Much as Fozzie did a very bad spin earlier as he tried to get himself under control.
And much as Jim Henson did when they performed Simon and Friends.
The Swedish Chef, I think, is really getting his own back after having been pushed on stage and then pushed off stage.
Mm-hmm.
This is where there is a deliberate cut. We've had Kermit and Fozzie interacting, and then when the Swedish Chef comes on, the camera cuts to him off to the side of the stage without Kermit and Fozzie in view, and then pans with him onto Kermit and Fozzie. And as Fozzie complains, saying, yeah, that's easy for you to say, Kermit makes a face but says nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm pretty sure that they used that camera cut as an opportunity to have Jim Henson both puppeteer and speak the Swedish Chef, and then have somebody else puppeteering Kermit. Which, to be fair, Kermit's doing the whole scrunchy, worried mouth thing. Frank Oz has been pretty vocal that nobody else can really do Kermit's facial expressions because that's Jim's hand and you can't really disguise it. If I hadn't been paying attention to the behind-the-scenes puppeteering of Jim Henson can't be in two places at once, I never would have doubted that Kermit was Kermit in that moment.
We then go to Muppet Labs.
Yeah, this was a surprise to me. I don't know why, per se, but it really leapt out at me that we hadn't had, and aside from Vets Hospital, we hadn't had any sort of name segments in the show.
Yeah, Newsman, Swedish Chef, but they're all, those were all abrupt.
Yeah, I suppose that's what I'm saying, is it's not that the show wasn't full of segments that we love and enjoy. It's that it was an enjoyable surprise for whatever reason. I hadn't thought this was going to be here. Maybe because it's a low Dave episode.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've got good Zoot moment in the previous Lou Rawls bit.
But otherwise, we only have Gonzo in the at the dance.
Yep.
And it's even a reused Dave in the beginning.
But Dave's in fine fettle here as Dr. Bunsen Honeydew, and he is here to introduce a new project, the nuclear-powered shaver. And he says the honor of shaving for the first time with it is going to his faithful assistant, Beaker.
And Beaker enters as nervous as he ever enters.
But he's doing proto-meeps here.
He's getting more and more vocal and more meep-like.
Yeah.
While still not doing meeps.
Come on in here, Beaker. It's all right. Come on. There you go.
They don't have P's at the end of it, but he's getting very close to me, 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 me.
Yep.
And that was an enjoyable to find and to notice.
I, being a bald man, thought that they were going to shave Beaker's head, but it's immediately revealed that, no, it's a facial shaver, because Bunsen is going to put a very heavy lead helmet on top of Beaker's head to protect his glorious hair.
Since I'm pointing out production necessities in this episode, I wanted to point out here that Dave does a really good job of having the helmet be heavy.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing vocal stuff of Bunsen grunting and really putting in efforts to carrying it.
I will also say Bunsen is a science nerd, so may not have muscles either. It may not actually be that heavy, but based off what happened with Beaker, obviously it's heavy.
So Beaker has to put his head down in order for Bunsen to put the helmet on top of him. But that's also because Bunsen has the same kind of manipulative hands that Fozzie and Rolf have,
mm-hmm.
which means the hands of the puppeteer come up through sleeves that have to be at the line of the desk or the bottom of the camera. Because if you lift them up, you'll then see the extended arms of the person in the hands go up. So Bunsen can't lift his hands up in order to put it on top of his taller assistant Beaker's head, because otherwise it will reveal long arms extending from beneath his arms. So there's a practical reason for him to be like, oh, this helmet is so heavy.
Yep.
And I really enjoyed that.
Once it does get on Beaker's head, Beaker is strong enough initially to stand straight.
That's
back
right.
Up. And then eventually the weight becomes too much that it pushes Beaker's neck and chin below the collar of his shirt.
With a not quite slide whistle sound, but a nice squealing of his head collapsing into his torso.
It's similar to when his neck deflated a few mm-hmm. episodes ago.
That's very good. It has that air squeaking out of a balloon sound.
Mm-hmm. And because his face is now covered by his shirt, there's no longer a need for him to be shaven. And so they never even turn on the device.
Bunsen laughingly declares this a success.
And then we cut to Kermit.
Kermit says, as you may have noticed, Fozzie has been taking up skating. So here he is with funny jokes and figure eights. And much like The Wall has come back and At the Dance has come back, we get a classic Fozzie in front of the bench in the park with the theme music doing stand-up. We haven't seen this stuff in such a long time. This is production episode 15. This is more than halfway through the season. And we're only just doing some of this stuff for the first time. I find this kind of remarkable as an episode.
Or maybe for the second or third time, but not since the first or second production episodes from this season.
Yes.
I think there were a couple of holdovers,
but so, then they basically got rid of all that stuff.
Yeah. Because we were just talking about this a couple weeks ago, how he wasn't performing with the comedians anymore.
Right. And he's doing classic Fozzie bits here, which also lends credence to the narrative. if this wasn't connected to the runner of the skates, that would also lend credence to our idea that maybe some of these things are plug-and-play stuff. Mm-hmm. But because this is part of a whole runner, this can't be. But potentially the at the dance, or of the three things that were returning, at the dance could have been something that was just hanging out that they used to fill in. But otherwise, this is literally just, we're doing a return to form.
Yep. Fozzie does some jokes, as you said, while skating. Stout and Waldorf do heckle him for a little bit. And then Fozzie retorts by saying, basically, oh yeah, well, I'm going to tell another joke and I'm going to skate backwards on one leg while wiggling my ears. And he does that, loses control of himself, skates off the stage, and crashes into the bottom of Statler and Waldorf's box. Now, Ben.
Yeah?
In the continuing saga of the Muppet Theater being a real House of Leaves situation.
Which, last time, I pointed out very clearly, you asserted the possibility that their box could have been a mile and a half away from the stage, and I said it couldn't have been because you can see it in shots like this.
Yes. However, it's also not feasible for Fozzie to have skated backwards at the rate of speed that he was skating at and hit their box.
Well,
also, we've seen Waldorf hanging desperately, needing help because he didn't want to fall, and then falling and hearing whistling while he crashes. And Fozzie hits basically where Waldorf was hanging from and falls.
And is able to stand back up and basically reach into the box.
Yeah. So, the box does move.
I think it's clear that there is a variable height in the box. Alternatively, there's a variable length in the proscenium because the stage extended so far out that Fozzie could roller skate all the way to the wall underneath the box seats.
But considering Statler and Waldorf have dropped things on audience members, that's also right. Not possible.
That's right. So, it may not be so much a House of Leaves situation as a House of Stairs situation.
House of Leaves also changes formations.
Does it?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
It ends with, after Fozzie does fall off the stage, Statler says he was doing okay until he fell off the stage.
And Waldorf says he was doing okay before he got on the stage in the first place.
Yeah, good way to end that.
Kermit comes on basically shaking his head. And says, once again, ladies and gentlemen, now backed by the band of Dr. Teeth.
And now, once again, ladies and gentlemen, this time backed by the big band of Dr. Teeth. Here he is, Mr. Lou Rawls!
Big band.
Okay.
Which, I understand the difference between a band and a big band.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of extra members of this band.
It's doubly true that because they've expanded their ranks, they have the instrumentation to be a jazz big band swing backing to Rawls's vocals, but also it is an indication that they needed more people besides just their normal five-piece rock formation.
But Dr. Teeth played with them
just during
Bye Bye Blackbird.
Uh-huh.
I assume, even though they're not pictured, they were the musicians for Groovy People.
Hmm.
So he says it like it's the first time that he's playing with Dr. Teeth.
Dr. Schultz?
Yes.
Dr. Pibb?
Well, I could go for a Dr. Pibb right now.
Pretty sure it's Mr. Pibb.
Oh, yeah, it is. Boo.
Yeah, I'm the one who got it wrong first.
Yeah. But then I confirmed it, and I love that soda.
Please, my father was Dr. Pibb. Call me Mr. Pibb.
So,
I think it's fair that the way in which he says it as it's a novelty that he finally gets to perform with Dr. Teeth, while Dr. Teeth had already blooped in to perform with him, is a bit weird in terms of the language department of hyping this up as an amazing thing. But it is kind of interesting
mm-hmm.
that they have created all these other musicians to play along, including not using some of the pit band musicians they already have.
Yep.
There has been a velveteen-suited female trumpeter that's been in the pit band and has worked along. When Floyd was going to lead the band on strike against Kermit, she was one of the walkouts, and yet she's nowhere to be seen in our expanded trumpets section here.
Nope.
We have a very weird one-off Whatnot Muppet, and we have Bobby Benson from Bobby Benson's Baby Band. I was just trying to remember, have we seen Bobby Benson's Baby Band prior to this?
We're about to. We will be talking about Bobby Benson next week.
Fascinating. That's kind of bizarre that he's about to show up and be this crazy, creepy baby band leader.
Apparently the babies debuted next season.
Okay.
So we'll just see him next episode.
All right. So Bobby Benson will be on next week's episode, but Bobby Benson's baby band has a ways to get to.
Yes.
They're crawling towards us slowly.
And he appears as a banjo player before the baby band is there. So Bobby Benson, well established.
As a virtuoso musician. Yeah. I never knew. I only thought of him as a creepy Svengali for infants.
Well, I'm even more wrong.
Okay.
Because the babies debut in season three, early in season three. Bobby Benson's baby band, not till late season three.
Okay.
But with our mysterious timeline of production episodes and airing episodes,
who knows in which they will end.
Yes. So all of this may be wrong. maybe wrong.
Oh, you say maybe too?
I say maybe too.
The song that they're playing, in addition to the additional trumpeters and the additional female saxophonist, who's weirdly kept apart from Zoot as if they're fighting, and their large black neon set behind Lou is set next to a mirror so that it makes it look like it's even longer and bigger.
Yep.
But you can tell pretty quickly that it's just the same performers in reverse. Very strange production decision.
Hey, they said it was a big band.
They did. And they wanted to get in the mirror union in order to make it seem even larger. The song that they're performing is the aforementioned You're the One, which is written by Lou's collaborators on his album and doesn't seem to be on that album. This is a fairly standard romantic number, and the lyrics are...
And all kinds of ladies do each and everything to me. But baby, let me tell you that you're the one.
And after a verse of that, the camera zooms back in order to reveal what we didn't see in the first couple camera angles, which is in front of Lou is a cafe table with Miss Piggy singing at it. And he is ostensibly singing this to her. But much like the Sleazoid brothers at the very beginning,
Sleaze brothers, how dare you?
He's not
put some respect on their name
to them. He's singing it above them to camera. And so while this is being positioned as a serenade to Piggy, he's sort of barely paying attention to her.
Yeah, I thought initially because of that, it was the game of he's singing it, she's thinking that it's about her, but it's not. But then at one point he does turn to her and say, "You're the one, Miss Piggy."
Yeah. And so he starts incorporating her name into the lyrics, and then she, you know, smiles and coos at him, but he's still very much performing it to us, and she's beneath his eye level of where he needs to be concentrating.
Yeah, she's a byproduct, not the point. So similar to my complaint with Groovy People, this is more of a performance than it is a Muppet Show moment.
Yeah. The musicianship of the big band in the background is shown. We get a couple of angles of horn points going up at key bits during the instrumentation. But aside from the fact that Lou is good at slipping in ad hoc, ad ham hoc lyrics in there, it's not something that's really different than what he'd be doing otherwise.
Nope. It's another Soul Train moment.
Yeah. He then ends by saying, "My little pork chop, my little sweet ham hock," to Miss Piggy.
Which traditionally would get him hayad.
But because he's saying it in romantic terms, even though it's still about turning pigs into food.
I'm pretty sure she's had that said to her positively before, and she still hayads people.
She seems swoonily overwhelmed by the charisma of his performance and doesn't seem to take it as something that requires to be responded to with violence.
Which, considering this episode had so little violence, I could have used some violence.
We go back to the curtain in order for Kermit to close the show. He says, "That's about all the time we have, but before we go," and as he says that, Fozzie skates past behind him saying, "I'm going now!"
And then Kermit says, "Let's thank Lou Rawls." And then Lou Rawls skates past saying very quickly, "Thank you, Kermit."
Lou's very funny in this because he never stops moving. He's clearly on some sort of platform. Like, he's not
Dolly
running.
Pole system.
They've got grips her stagehands on either side, and he's got his hands out in a very good approximation of I'm balancing on a surfboard movement, but he's never not blurry in this. Award-winning podcast, never not blurry. And it's kind of fun that his final moment in this is egoless enough, especially because in Groovy People, he sings the lyric, I hate people with big egos, that he's like, yeah, I'm going out on this, but I'd much rather be a punchline than I'd be, it's all about me.
Yeah, and then Fozzie slides back the other way, Lou slides back the other way, and then a whole bunch of Muppets, including the Sleaze Brothers.
Oh, how dare you?
What do you mean? I put the proper respect on
them. That's what I'm saying. How dare you? They're clearly sleazy. Therefore, they don't deserve your respect.
Ben, you are what you eat. You are not your name.
I think Victor Frankenstein's nominative ironic determinism would disagree with you.
Well, that's fictional.
Unlike these very real Muppets.
Yeah, we've seen them multiple times, and we've seen them portrayed by Dave Thomas and Michael McKean, who are real people.
I was going to say,
QED.
I missed out on an opportunity to go to the newly refurbished sounds of Lincoln Center in order to sing with the real Kermit the Frog when they did an open public call to sing along with him in order to test out the new acoustics. So Kermit the Frog was in real life in New York City.
So the Sleaze Brothers are real. So put some respect on their name.
They weren't there. I can't
prove.
Wait,
were you there? No.
So maybe they weren't. My friend Mike was there.
Okay.
And
so let's get Mike on the phone and find out if he's there.
All right. To be determined later. But my wild speculation while Kermit is real, not everybody else on the Muppet Show was. Some of them were just special effects.
So yeah, episode ends with people sliding across stage.
Well, it really ends with Statler and Waldorf.
True.
With Statler saying, I love tonight's show.
Waldorf says, really?
And Statler says, no, I just wanted to see if I could say it. What he should have said was, I should have seen if I could say it without laughing.
Because and then that could have given Waldorf a way to go, oh, I didn't laugh either.
Good punch up.
45 years.
Baby.
Even though that was on the top of my head, because I'm a good semi-professional comedian.
Well, you've told us how many hits we've had in the episode, and I'm pretty sure, based on a rough count, that we have no explosions and no kisses. So let's get into music and rankings.
Musically, for a musician, this was middle of the pack, if not lower half. I think due to the fact that one of his segments was outside. He didn't just do songs, which is to his credit. There was 12 minutes and 16 seconds worth of music in this episode. The episode was 26 minutes and 30 seconds long, so it was 46.3% music.
Wow. Even with doubling up on the Vets Hospital theme, it was that short.
I don't count the Vets Hospital theme.
Oh, even though there's an organ.
Yeah, it's so short, I don't count it, even though I do count the Swedish Chef singing intro, but not the rest of the music. Once he stops singing, I stop, and I do count the Pigs in Space intro. Listen, Ben. I'm wildly inconsistent, but I'm consistent in my inconsistency.
I'm not sure that's true.
No, absolutely is. I'm the one who keeps numbers. As far as rankings, obviously, based off my comments, he's pretty low.
I did wonder whether or not he would bottom out and you would bump everybody else up.
I thought about it, but
he's charming.
He is charming, and I appreciate that he tried, even though he's not good at it.
Even though he's not trying to explode his image.
Yeah. And so I put him at 22.
Who would you rather see than him again, and who would you rather see him than?
He is above Judy Collins and Bob Hope.
Rude.
Hey, Bob's cue cards were atrocious. And I put him just below Rudolph and Zero Mostel. But it did cause a massive shift.
Yeah.
Because I had 17 free. So, or maybe I had 18 free. But Edgar Bergen is now 17 or was 17. Steve Martin definitely moved up to 18. Don up to 19. Rudolph up to 20. Zero up to 21.
So that gap that you'd been carefully keeping open has now been squished together.
Yeah. So with 4 episodes left this season.
That's right.
I have 6 open, I have 8 open, I have 12 open, I have 14 open.
Interesting. I'll be very surprised if our next couple, I think one of them might be great. because she's doing barley pops off a leap. And
I don't know what that means.
Cloris Leachman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have high hopes for that episode.
And so could easily slot into one of those top third episodes, no trouble. But
or move people down, depending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I'd be very surprised if there wasn't more shifting going on as you go. Because I think that's what you've been doing this season is saying, I think that
I would rather watch
this person than this one, is that's where you've been making space. And so I think other people are going to shift into those gaps.
Yeah.
As you find a natural home for somebody.
I really enjoyed Lou's segments.
Yeah.
His songs were great. But I really didn't like how they were just Soul Train. And so I had to rank him lower than that. I probably would rather watch Lou's performances than Swine
Lake.
Yes, again, because I also don't like dancing. I'd much rather listen to Lou Rawls than watch dancing. But it was a better segment.
According to the criteria we've set up. Yes. That's not the only thing we're judging these.
Correct. So, 22. Sorry, Lou. Now, do we do minifig now?
Yeah.
Okay. I had a massive lead coming into this.
Yes, you did.
You made up a lot of ground, but not enough. Which was another reason why I threw in a bonus question. Because if you got everything right, we would have tied.
So the bonus question might have been necessary to sway it over the line.
Yeah. So, I win my second minifig.
What are the numbers for the quarter?
I had 6 points, you had 4 points.
All right, with two minifigs left, are you picking one or are you picking two?
Well, it's my second minifig, so I'm going to take number two. Let's see what we got here. We have... I got Gonzo and Camilla.
Oh! Weirdly enough, I'm more jealous about the second part.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I love Gonzo, but...
A tiny little Lego chicken. But it's not just a chicken. It's got the eye makeup.
Yeah.
So it's painted very specifically to be Camilla and not just a chicken.
But also, to make the jealousy a little bit less, Gonzo has no other toys. So while the Swedish chef had lots of...
accoutrements.
Yeah. Lots of abapan. Gonzo just has Camilla.
Very cool.
Very pleased.
Well, speaking of pleased, let's talk about some of our favorite aspects of the episode by closing out with our five favorite moments. I'm going to start by talking about the first backstage interaction between Scooter, Chef Fozzie, and Kermit in one specific aspect of Fozzie's roller skating.
Mm-hmm.
When he is whirling around out of control, he then does a little spin and goes towards the camera to disappear off screen. And Fozzie then comes back, bursting past the trio of Scooter, Chef, and Kermit to then bounce down the stairs and go out the back doors.
I think I've almost got a lick, Kermit!
The back doors have been getting slightly increased prominence in terms of their reality over the course of the season.
Mm-hmm.
It's been variable as to how real they are.
Or practical.
Yes. The alligators going down there, Rudolph and Ray of coming up, I think they weren't entirely real then, and I think that awkwardness has made them start to make them more and more feasible. All that said, they still can't be completely real because we don't see Fozzie's legs when he skates down and out the doors.
I think the doors are real. I think the stairs are not real.
For example, therefore, Rudolph couldn't have walked up those stairs unless they recreated them differently for this special effect. But this effect is fantastic. We talked in the episode where Kermit steps in gum about how Bailey talked about he thought it was hilarious to have the reality of the Muppets be conveyed by something that was never shown on camera.
Mm-hmm.
And Fozzie and Frank do fantastic jobs of constantly making us believe that he's not quite steady on his feet, which do not exist. But here is the best occasion of that, where he bounces down those stairs, where he goes out and down, and there's an added sound effect to help sell the reality of it. But really, the visual of the out drop that would really happen if you were skating downstairs, if your velocity and gravity combined that you are basically clunking at right angles is so well performed for something that isn't physically real at all. I'm overwhelmed with how impressed I was by that.
I just want to mention it was one of my moments as well, so I was equally impressed. I wouldn't have said so as eloquently as you, though, so I'm glad you took it. For my first moment, our second moment, I want to dive into a moment that we kind of skimmed over, and I was very pleased we skimmed over it, which is right after that moment. When Scooter and Kermit shove the chef on stage, we mentioned that he starts halfway into his song, and the Swedish chef clears his throat before hurriedly jumping into the song. And then once he's done with the song, instead of throwing the colander and whisk backwards, he throws it at Scooter and Kermit.
Yeah, we've done the Swedish Chef throwing things, I think, three or four times as moments. This one was precious.
Yeah. So it's that little throat clear and then throwing it at Kermit and Scooter. If it was one of those things, I might be like, yeah, that was fun. The two of them are so close, are two amazing choices that work so well together.
I very specifically didn't talk about it because I heard you elide past it when you were first describing it.
I have started doing that.
And I was like, that's his moment. I'm going to leave that one alone. Not knowing anything about Lou Rawls, I was intrigued by one of his ongoing narratives in the episode, which is not just his ability to improvise lyrics over the course of a song, but also he has a very fascinating hyperverbal style. And it's one of the things Kermit is commenting upon when he does his bit of saying, when I say the exact same thing you said, it doesn't work. I think that Rawls's delivery may have been a little stilted, a little artificial at times, but sometimes he was in his element, where he was doing whatever he does as a professional and as a person that helped make him a super charismatic performer that won over the nation for a little bit. And I want to focus on one of those specific moments, which is in the talk spot when Kermit has opened with his bad dad joke of saying, I have all your records back at my pad, my lily pad, my pad. Ross just stares him down, which, let's point out, is the correct response to a dad joke. And when Kermit leans into the awkwardness and says, that's a joke, Rawls says the coolest thing I've ever heard in my life.
That's a little joke here.
Only possibly, Kermit, only possibly.
And I will never be as cool as he is, and I will never be cool enough to pull off that line, but I want to try. If I'm lucky, I will be able to stare down somebody who has just made an assertion and say that line with as much devastating effect as Rawls did in that moment.
For my final moment, my second moment, our fourth moment, I want to talk about one of the final moments in the show, which is another Fozzie skating moment. At the end, Fozzie is so close to the camera as he pulls Kermit off screen. And it just, it amazed me. Like, we'd seen Fozzie skating around, doing pirouettes, doing figure eights.
Doing half of a figure eight. Let's point out, when he says, I'm going to do a figure eight, he does not do anything close to a figure eight.
He doesn't close the top of the eight. He doesn't,
He does a lumpy loop. He never crosses himself.
He does cross.
I disagree.
Because he does, he starts at the top, does the straight line to the first loop, the bottom of the eight, and then he crosses over and then falls off the stage.
In the first figure eight, before he's doing the thing.
Okay, the first figure eight. The second figure eight.
Is just a lump.
Well, that's not my moment because that's not good. but the moment where Fozzie is so close to the camera that it's just a blurry ball of fuzz, I laughed really hard at how close he was. And then, yes, he just pulls Kermit off stage and that's when the credits roll. I enjoyed that too. But it was his proximity to camera that made me laugh real hard.
For my final moment, our final moment, it would have been good to have done that. Very close to final moment. But I'm not. I'm going to drag us kicking and screaming back to the first third of the episode.
and talk about the Vets Hospital sketch. This is a great Vets Hospital sketch. And one of the jokes is that they do the same jokes twice.
He was here a minute ago.
Oh, wow, this is happening a lot lately.
What is?
Dr. Bob is losing his patience.
And because they're doing it faster and they're doing it again, they're doing it artificially.
Mm-hmm.
Except Janice. Janice does it the second time with total commitment, as if she's never done it before.
He was here a minute ago.
Oh, wow, this is happening a lot lately.
What is?
Dr. Bob is losing his patience.
Piggy and Rolf are going through the motions, but Janice, in her weird stoned way, is just living it all again, as if it was the first time.
Ben, this episode I mentioned earlier was directed by Philip Cassidy.
Yes.
I think there may have been a guest director for that segment.
Mm.
And Janice had taken direction from George Lucas himself when he said, faster but more intense.
But she doesn't do it more intense. Everybody else is doing it faster and more awkward.
Well, she's more intense than the other two.
It's true.
The other two got less intense. So by
she's proxy, truly doing it. Yeah. So well done, George Lucas, for getting Richard Hunt to give a wonderfully dynamic performance in that way. Janice is on fire in that sketch. And I don't think she gets as many really great moments to shine in Vets Hospital as mm-hmm. the other two performers. She's definitely the third banana in that bunch.
Ooh.
And I don't know why it struck me. I think because the others were doing a heightened, more artificial performance, just how good she is struck me anew in this particular episode. And now we have to say all that again at 1.5 speed.
I didn't write that down like I wrote down my summary, where I wrote everything down twice. So that's going to be really difficult for me this time. Also, it's going to be hard to get that car that was driving past to come
especially
back.
At 1.5 speed.
Yeah. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Leon Amley. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cones, Yes We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast to Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter at @FarstNameBasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
All excerpts in the podcast are used for the purposes of review. There are things, dates, facts, names, things, dates, facts, names, things, dates, facts, names, bird types, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website. We'll post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete. My co-host is Ben.
Car! Car!
And we'll see you next week when we discuss Season 2, Production Episode 18, guest starring the person, not the financial institution, J.P. Morgan.